Good evening, everyone. Or good afternoon, I guess. I think it's on. I'm Marion Dove from the Department of Family Medicine and also Director of Faculty Development for the new curriculum. You're not hearing me? Is that better? No. Are people hearing me? Lean into the microphone. To move this in. Otherwise, very. Ah, there we go. How's that? Good evening, everyone. We'll try again, second time. I'm Marion Dove. I'm from the Department of Family Medicine, and I'm Director of Faculty Development for the new curriculum. And I'm very happy to welcome you all here this evening for this special town hall event about the new undergraduate medical curriculum, which will be launching in September of this year. It's nice to see such a big turnout on a Thursday evening. There are several physicians here tonight to talk to you about the new curriculum and the main components of the new curriculum. And in keeping with CME practices at McGill, I just want to let you know that we have no conflicts of interest to disclose. I was asked to moderate this event because it's a faculty development event in the broad sense of the term faculty development. So I suspect most of you are aware that faculty development means ongoing professional learning for educators. In general, we apply the principles of adult learning theory, meaning that we want to have interactive sessions. So we are this evening going to have a long question and answer period and a lot of time for discussion. Part of this this evening is going to be influential for us in the dynamic process of curricular renewal, because the new curriculum is not a static thing. It's a dynamic thing, and as the new curriculum unrolls, we will be taking into account feedback and concerns that people have, and also interested to hear what the successes are. So we're very happy to have you all here tonight as part of this interactive event. I want to let people know that we are being live streamed, so people are watching us on the internet and listening to us. So when we have the question and answer period, I will be repeating your question into the microphone, and we will ask the speakers to come up to the lectern to answer the questions. We do have a few educational objectives for the evening, so that you don't feel like you wasted your time coming here. The main thing is to outline the general structure of the new MDCM curriculum. We're going to describe to you the principles underlying the framework for the new curriculum. We will explain the process of development of the new curriculum, because it's been about a six-year process. And we're going to engage in some discussion with you in the audience about the challenges and opportunities that are associated with the new curriculum. The way we proceed, propose to proceed is that first Dr. Robert Primavesi will talk to you. He is the Associate Dean of Undergraduate Medical Education here at McGill. After that, Dr. Colin Chalk will speak. He is chair of the component of the new curriculum entitled Fundamentals of Medicine and Dentistry, which is going to be the first 18 months or so of the new curriculum, 16 months exactly. Next, Dr. Laurie Plotnick will talk to you about the new curriculum component entitled Transition to Clinical Practice. And finally, Dr. Beth Cummings will talk to you about the clerkship component. Each person is going to try and limit themselves to about 10 minutes, so that we will be done with the presentation by about 5:45, and we have until 7 o'clock in this room. We announced that we're here till 6:30, but if people want to stay, we can actually stay till 7. So with that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Dr. Primavesi.
Thanks, Marion. And it is great to see such a great turnout today. All right. So the last time we had a major curriculum renewal at McGill was in 1994. And I've put a few milestones of what's happened over the last 19 years up on the slide here. I was wondering if anybody, if you read through this, if you have any comments about how either medicine or education or the world has changed in the last 19 years. Supposed to be the interactive part of the. It was not a rhetorical question.
More skeptical, less trusting.
More skeptical, less trusting. Salim always has it. And sure, technology informatics has really huge difference. If you wanted to access a journal in 1994, you had to really go to the library to do so. Now things are instantaneously available, and the amount of information that's available is much bigger than it was before. Anything else?
Lots of things haven't changed.
Like our salaries. Okay. And they're not going to change in the near future. People are still publishing scientific papers, absolutely.
Genetics,
absolutely. The whole genome and the role of genetics and the role that genetics will play in the future of medicine is really different. We talked about technology, certainly communication and how access information, how medical students access information, how they communicate with each other, and with a growing global population, certainly the needs of society have probably changed as well. I'm sure we could come up with more, but just to get you a little bit thinking about why we need curricular change. So really the curricular renewal process started with strategic planning that was put forward by Richard Levin when he was dean. So that was started in 2008, and there were three prongs to the strategic plan. One was research, one was faculty life cycle, and the third was educational design. And the vision of the educational design group was that McGill should be recognized as Canada's foremost medical undergraduate program, preparing future generations of graduates that take their place as leading medical practitioners, educators, and research. And with the values of physicianship, so student or the physician as both healer and professional, addressing the needs of society, and training our medical graduates to be adaptable to the changes and the very rapid changes that will happen in the future, and scholarship in terms of independent learning. These are the members of the educational design group, so quite broad representation from the faculty, undergraduate administration, residents, and medical students. So the report said many things, but the conclusion was defined the attributes of what we want in a graduating medical student from McGill, The attributes are that a student demonstrates stage-appropriate clinical expertise, which kind of makes sense, demonstrates the properties of the physicianship, so healing and professionalism, has effective communication skills, has interprofessional skills, is able to work as part of a team because that's how medicine is practiced these days, has critical thinking and decision-making, is able to adapt to changes in practice, technology, and society needs, understands the healthcare system and the role of public health, and through independent work, the understanding of scholarship. So that's pretty broad and makes lots of sense. In parallel to the McGill strategic planning process, the Association of Faculties of Medicine in Canada also looked at how medicine is taught across Canada, and so this involves all 17 of Canada's medical schools. And their recommendation for undergraduate medical education in the future is that in a report that came out in March 2010, or May 2010, just shortly after McGill's report, says that we should address individual and community needs, so the needs of the student as well as the needs of the community that we serve. We need to enhance the admissions process so we increase the diversity of the students that we accept into medicine, and therefore the they in turn will serve a wider population. Medicine is built on science, and we have to teach basic science. That we need to promote prevention in public health. We need to address the hidden curriculum so that the message that students get in medical school are the same as they get when they enter the hospitals, and they're not getting mixed messages or contradictory messages. We need to diversify the learning contexts. Medicine happens largely now in an outpatient setting, and we still teach our students on the inpatient wards for the majority of the time, and there's a discordance in how they learn about the realities of what they're going to be practicing in the future. We need to value generalism, so in part that means family medicine, but it also means all general specialties so that we can really meet all the health needs of the population. We need to advance internal interprofessional practice. We need to adopt a competency-based and flexible approach to medical education. We need to foster medical leadership. So it's a lot of stuff to do, and we have to be quite creative to try and include all these recommendations in designing the new curriculum. And in part, this creates a bit of tension in how do you do all of this. As you will hear in terms of the curricular design later on, to be able to allow an earlier clinical experience in medical school and to allow more independent learning and more small group experience, we've had to cut back the number of lecture hours. So that means the number of lecture hours, the number of hours of basic sciences that are taught in medical school is significantly less in the new curriculum than it was in the old curriculum. And that gives a perception that basic science is less valued in the new curriculum. And I will say that I don't think that's true, and hopefully by the end of this presentation you will be convinced that that's not true. But it does create a bit of a tension. So a very respected faculty member told me, speaking about curricular design, that what are you doing with the new curriculum? We're going to turn McGill into a family medicine factory just like Sherbrooke. And we should be producing clinician scientists. So this person's right. We should be producing clinician scientists. Unfortunately, we also need to produce, or fortunately, we also need to produce family physicians. When the graduating class of 2017, which will be the first class to experience the new curriculum, graduates, 55% of postgraduate training positions are going to be in family medicine. Results from the current CARMS match. We're at 28% this year, 31% last year, 28%. So if we maintain the status quo in 2017, when our medical students graduate, 27% of them will be unemployed in Quebec, or they will have to go elsewhere out of the province to actually achieve their medical goals. So we have to both address the needs of society and meet society's needs as well as the medical students, and that's where some of the tension exists. So I'm going to skip over that slide. The other thing coexisting, the Association of Faculty of Medicine in Canada looked at postgraduate training, and they also have 10 recommendations. And one of the recommendations is that there should be smooth transitions between practice, so that we should have smooth transitions from medical school into residency and residency into practice. And so when we look at clerkship, you'll see that we're actually trying to do that. But I think that actually needs to go backwards further. I think we need to look at the admissions process so that we actually select students that are well-suited and to succeed within our curriculum and meet the curricular outcome goals. Admissions will be looking at prerequisites for entry into medical school, because realistically, with the amount of technology and knowledge that's there, we can't teach everything in medical school. So we have to assume that medical students do come prepared with a certain amount of knowledge so that they can actually master the information. So we do have a website. The first website is on the UGME page. And to coincide with the town hall, we've actually launched a new website, which we'll be adding to. So it launched today. You can actually access it. And if you Google new curriculum, MDCM McGill, you will actually get there. So you can actually keep track of what we're doing. The basic components of the curriculum will not change. There will still be a fundamentals part over the first 18 months. We included dentistry because dentistry is part of the 18 months of the curriculum. There will be a preclinical phase called transitions to clinical practice before the students actually get to clerkship, and physicianship apprenticeship will run throughout the 4 years. We have certain themes that are incorporated in the curricular design, and these partly reflect the FMEC recommendations and some of the values that we feel important are to McGill. So, for instance, we have a good Indigenous health program, patient safety, which is a big accreditation issue. Student wellness and career advising, and these themes are actually interwoven throughout the 4 years of the curriculum and don't have a discrete start and stop. There's also been certain departments or groups that have approached the curriculum executive, wanting to be sure that they are well represented within the curriculum, and they've had proposals, and we've in some way been able to incorporate them and match the objectives to make sure that they're represented. So we do have a new curriculum advisory group. So we've actually asked all the departments part of the faculty of medicine to appoint somebody to the advisory group. And the role of the advisory group is to give us feedback on what we've been doing and to bring that information back to individual departments. So how do you get started with this? Well, it's actually makes sense to start with the end and look at where you want to end up. So we're actually using the Medical Council of Canada objectives, which outline the qualifications for a graduating medical student entering independent practice in Canada. And those are based on clinical presentations, and then we've mapped these back over the curriculum. And those are the minimum, so we can always add on to it. And from an educational design, it actually makes sense that we actually start with what the outcome is, think about teaching strategies, how we're going to assess it, where you want to end up actually drives the curricular content. So this is what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes, the new MD-MCM curriculum. You'll see the pink part at the top is of the first 18 months, which are fundamentals of medicine and dentistry. We have transitions to clinical practice in gray. We have core clerkship in purple and senior clerkship in blue. And I'm going to hand it over to Colin Chalk to talk about fundamentals of medicine and dentistry.
Thanks, Rob. I know most of the people in the room. Most of the people know me. My day job is I'm a neurologist. The other day job I have is that I run what's called Unit 6 in the basis of medicine, which is basically the neuroanatomy block. And with the retirement this year of Ann Wexler, I think I'm now the longest surviving unit chair in basis of medicine. So I've been doing that since 1998. So I can claim to have a lot of hands-on experience in the trenches doing this kind of teaching. So what's new in fundamentals of medicine and dentistry? I'm going to look at four things briefly. The overall organization, content, the presence of family medicine, and a problem that's somewhat unique to our medical school, the problem of integrating or connecting physicianship with the rest of what happens in the first 18 months of the curriculum. So I'll do these one by one. And I have to take either credit or blame is not solely on my shoulders. I've had since the beginning a committee involved in thinking about all of these things, some of whom are in the room, and by no means they are by no means the only people who have contributed to what's gone on, but these are the people who, with whom I meet regularly. So fundamentals of medicine, dentistry will, like basis of medicine, follow a basic organ system design so that we go through organ systems one by one, rather like we do in basis of medicine now. The two main differences for those of you who are familiar with BOM is the beginning block, now called Molecules to Global Health, takes a rather broader perspective of what medicine is about than our current introductory unit, which is really a sort of compressed course in molecular biology or cellular biology. The other important difference is that currently the fall of second year, and so the way I've arranged this, the first block on the left-hand side is up to Christmas of first year, the lower block is Christmas to summer break, and the block on the right-hand side is the fall of second year. Right now, in the fall of second year, students in basis of medicine do what's called Unit 8, which is essentially the abnormal. And so what we're proposing to do is to get away from the paradigm of spending a year on the normal followed by 6 months on the abnormal, and instead teach the abnormal and the normal side by side for each organ system. Now, the content. What should students learn in fundamentals of medicine and dentistry, or indeed what should students learn in medical school, is a very difficult question. I offer you the following quotation. The author is not in the room, I don't think. This is extracted from an ongoing email discussion, which I'm CC'd on, about what on earth are they doing to the medical curriculum. I don't think anybody would dispute that this is an idea of what we should hope that our medical students emerge from our school with. The devil is in the details, of course. And what exactly is an adequate understanding of basic science? What is an adequate understanding of disease? We could spend the rest of the evening discussing. I find it helpful to use this paradigm, which I learned from Peter MacLeod, who I'm not sure Peter claims to have invented this, but one can look at material in a medical curriculum as belonging to three categories: things that doctors must know, things that doctors should know, and things that it's nice if doctors know. And presumably, if we have to make choices, we've got to choose the must-know over the should-know and the nice-to-know. So that's all very well. How do we judge these things? Well, trying to decide what every doctor should know is an unanswerable problem. There are many ways to try and do this. One that I personally think is defensible and valid is what, as it's turned out, the Medical Council of Canada has decided to use, and this is a way to try and summarize medical knowledge by asking oneself, well, if you sit down in a room and make a list of all the reasons why people go to the doctor, that ought to be some way to capture what the boundary of medical knowledge ought to be. And so this exercise, which was developed by colleagues in Calgary about 20 years ago, has been refined and developed. Many people in this room contributed to the development of this list of what are called clinical presentations. And this has now been used by the Medical Council of Canada as the blueprint for their qualifying exam, the exam that our graduates have to take in order to practice medicine in Canada. And it's imperfect, but if you look at it, you go to the MCC website, which this will hopefully allow me to do. All right. Oh, hang on. I see. Oh, it's an apple. That's the problem. Okay. All right. The Revenge of Bill Gates. How do I get back to my PowerPoint slide, somebody?
The arrow up top.
Two X.
Okay. I invite you to look at the Medical Council of Canada website. But But you'll see that this list is about 120 or so items. And if you look through it, if you're a physician in any walk of life, I think you'll have to agree that it's actually a very comprehensive, defensible list of this is what a doctor ought to know. So this gives us a means to sort of, as a kind of checklist, to say, well, we should make sure we've got this, this, and this, and if we're teaching this and it's hard to see how this relates to these clinical presentations, why is it there? Doesn't mean it can't be there, but we have to, I think about it carefully. So new in fundamentals of medicine dentistry will be a major presence of family medicine. And the longitudinal family medicine experience, which has this wonderful poster that I'm grateful to Lenny Lala for allowing me to use, is to tell you a little bit about this. So the longitudinal family medicine program for any given student will occur twice a month from the 1st of September of first year. It will be the experience in family medicine practices, family medicine clinics will be based on an interaction between the student and preceptors that Lenny is finding and vetting. And what happens in those clinics will be explicitly linked to what's happening in the classroom at the same time, will be evaluated. And in order to make all this happen, we can't send 200 people all to one family medicine clinic on Tuesday afternoon, and so we have to spread it out through the week. And what we think is the way to make this feasible is actually to divide the class into five portions. So on any given afternoon, roughly a fifth of the class will be at their family medicine placement. And that means the sort of knock-on effect of that is that changes how we can sort of schedule what we do with teaching activities. And so teaching activities in which we want the whole class together will be in the mornings only. And things that happen in the afternoon have to be done twice or more to make sure everybody gets it. And some people in the room took a long time to figure out how this worked, but it is actually doable. And I'm sparing you the details of the schedule. I've got it in my bag, and we can go out day by day through the 18 months if you want, but that's the basic idea. The fourth issue that the FMD will hopefully be able to help is what I refer to as the BOM physicianship disconnect. If you're a medical student in our curriculum, this is what your week looks like. The blue is basis of medicine. The pink is physicianship. This has a number of unfortunate consequences if you talk to our students. There seems to be a hidden message, maybe it's not so hidden, that medical school consists of hard stuff, the real medicine in blue, and the soft stuff, the pink stuff, all that touchy-feely stuff, and that maybe what happens on Wednesday afternoon isn't really important. Now, of course, this is exactly the opposite of the message we're trying to give. And the virtues of the physicianship program, which are many, are, I think, rather lost in this current structure. Another problem is that there are very many missed opportunities. Physicianship and BOM might as well be happening in different continents. There's relatively little interaction between the excellent people on both sides of the stream. And so when the neuroanatomy unit and neurological disease is being discussed on the blue blocks, one could easily have ethical, legal, and other such aspects of brain disease being discussed in the pink days, but it doesn't happen. And it's not for lack of goodwill and trying and so forth, but it's just the structure is built so it doesn't work. So what are we going to do? Essentially what we want to do is turn that into this. So in other words, we would take the physicianship themes and topics, sprinkle them throughout the blocks of FMD, and as much as possible use block-specific illustrations of the principles that are being taught in the physicianship curriculum. Somewhat parallel to this, we've proposed to advance the teaching of the physical exam and the history-taking part of our teaching to first year from second year. and align this with the blocks. So, for example, during the respiration block, one of the things students will do is begin to learn how to take a history from a patient with respiratory disease, as well as how to examine the chest, and so forth throughout the year. And the hope is to make all these things better aligned from the perspective of students. I will now turn the microphone over to Laurie, who will tell you what happens after students leave FMD.
So I'm going to talk to you about the second 6 months of the second year. Sorry. And I figured that it was probably better if we talk just current about what's going on currently, because many of you may not know what happens after the Kern bomb. So in the second half of second year, there's a six-month component called Introduction to Clinical Medicine. And really what it is meant to be is a transition period between the basic science university-based teaching and the clerkship clinical experience. It's actually a very unique program, unique to McGill. Most medical schools are 2 years in university-based and 2 years of clerkship. And what it is an opportunity for the students to start being exposed to patient care and patient care practices. They're not directly responsible for patient care as they are in clerkship. They do have patient contact. It's not always that way. So most of the rotations, the students will have direct patient contact, but there are rotations currently, such as pediatrics and radiology, where they don't have any patient contact. And it becomes an environment where the students are having more individualized teaching, but they're also being asked to take more personal responsibility for their learning and achieving the objectives. So what happens currently is that in January, there's about three and a half weeks of what we call professional skills, where the whole class of about 180 students are on the same schedule, and they are really at this point learning physical exam for the most part. They do have an opportunity to practice evidence-based medicine, have some introductory lectures on such things as psychiatry and ophthalmology, but for the most part, that what is concentrated is teaching them how to learn the physical, how to do physical exam. Then the next 21 weeks, the entire class is divided into three cohorts, so cohorts of 60 students, and they rotate through three blocks. They obviously don't all rotate in the same order, but all of them participate in three main blocks, which includes introduction to internal medicine, during which time there's also one half day of pediatrics a week, introduction to surgery, radiology, and ophthalmology for 7 weeks, and what we call FONA, which is family medicine, oncology, neurology, and anesthesia for 7 weeks. So in the new curriculum, when this was being envisioned, the idea was maybe we really don't need this 6 months. The idea is to allow students to have more clinical exposure early on. We really don't maybe need the 6 months, and we would align with many of the other medical schools. And it was the students who actually made a plea saying, please leave this in. It's a really favorite part of the curriculum. We love it. It gives us great exposure, experience, transition without us feeling stressed that we all of a sudden have to know everything about patient care. So it was kept in as part of the new curriculum and renamed Transition to Clinical Practice, because actually it's no longer an introduction to clinical medicine. As Colin detailed, students from day one will be exposed to clinical medicine. So about a year ago, we put together a committee, and as you'll see by the committee members, we have a diverse group of people, not meant to represent every single discipline, every single department, but there are people from various departments with different levels of expertise in undergraduate medical education, postgraduate medical education, to really sit with a really open mind, out-of-the-box thinking of what do we really want in this 6 months, and to critically evaluate what has been done, what works, what doesn't work, and how can we make it even better. And the idea is that at the end of TCP, the students should be able to consolidate and demonstrate good data gathering skills, meaning they are comfortable with the history and physical exam, getting some lab data, medical imaging data, and then being able to understand how to translate that data into something that's clinically meaningful, like a differential diagnosis, even a simple management plan. Students should also be able to demonstrate critical appraisal skills, minor procedural skills, IV insertion, bag mask ventilation, and show an understanding of the healthcare system, public health, and ethics. So with that in mind, as we were developing the framework and as we are developing the content, we are basing a lot of what we do on some guiding principles. First and foremost, we want to make sure that the students, after finishing TCP, have a readiness for clerkship. That's obvious. They come from fundamentals of medicine and dentistry, and we want to get them to clerkship. And the way we did that is, as Colin suggested with the Medical Council of Canada clinical presentations, is we developed TCP-specific objectives. So what did we do? We took the McGill MDCM objectives, which cover all the CanMeds roles, and created a document that was specific to where we wanted the students to be after TCP. We also, in conjunction with the clerkship committee, we looked at all the clinical presentation for MCC and said, well, which ones are appropriate for the level of a second-year student and where we want them to be before starting clerkship, and what is more appropriate for a more advanced medical student. And we divided up the clinical presentations and even more so divided up the objectives within the clinical presentations, either to TCP or to clerkship, and even within those objectives and clinical presentations, decided which was the best department discipline to be responsible for helping the students achieve those objectives. We also wanted to make sure and want to make sure that as we create the framework and the content, that there is integration of the themes and interest groups that Rob has spoken about. So things like public health and diversity, we wanted to make sure that within the framework and within each course rotation, that we were maintaining this longitudinal teaching and integration. We want to, as much as possible, offer the students a longitudinal experience. We know that it's easier for them to actually integrate information if they get ideas and content in small digestible pieces rather than all at once intense. So, for example, we are integrating a medical ethics health law course, which is going to be 8 sessions, and we could have easily said we have, you know, first 2 days of one block, go for it, you have 2 days, cover all that you need to cover, but we know that it's much more meaningful to do that over 8 weeks, a small amount over 8 weeks, so they can take what they're learning and apply it clinically and apply it to the other aspects of that block. And finally, of course, we want to make sure, as we're doing this, is that we really strive for educational excellence. It's easy to say, it's harder to do. We don't only want the content to be excellent, but we want to make sure that the teaching and learning methods that we are using are excellent, and hopefully we can integrate some innovative practices at the same time. So where are we now? Where we're just at now in terms of TCP is we've just finished creating the proposed framework. And what it means now for the new curriculum is that because the physical exam will be taught in the first 18 months, we no longer have to do that in January of second year. So we actually have a total of 24 weeks to play with. And what we've done is we've taken the 24 weeks, and rather than have the whole class together at the beginning, we will be dividing them up into cohorts of 60 students right away, starting right away with one of 3 blocks. And they will have 3 blocks of 8 weeks. And those 3 blocks are as follows. One of the blocks is named Core and Consultative Medicine, and that will include internal medicine, neurology, and evidence-based medicine. What it will be specifically, but I can't give more specifics than this, we're just working on this now, is there will be 6 weeks of internal medicine, 2 weeks of neurology, and a critical academic half days, and those academic half days will actually be one morning a week, where it will be an integration of internal medicine and neurology. So whether you're doing neurology or the student is participating in internal medicine, it will not determine what they are learning in the academic half days, because the entire cohort of 60 students will be participating in that academic half day once a week. And in addition, there will be an evidence-based medicine critical appraisal project, which will be related to one of the clinical presentations in either internal medicine or neurology, depending on the student's choice, where they will look at the clinical presentation in a critical way and answer a question based on their evidence-based medicine skills and knowledge. So it means that the challenge is that there will be 60 students who have to rotate through this block in various ways. Some will have neurology at the beginning, some will have neurology at the end, and some will have their 6 weeks of internal medicine interrupted by 2 weeks of neurology. So it is a challenge. We are working on that. But the idea is that there are basic skills, core and consultative skills, whether it's in internal medicine or neurology, that they should be learning and building throughout these 8 weeks. The second block is titled Diagnostic and Interventional Medicine. And as you can see, it makes much more sense. Rather than having anesthesia with family medicine, not that there's not a link there, it makes much more sense to try and integrate surgery, anesthesia, radiology, and ophthalmology all in one block to build on the learning. The idea here is that the students will start with 1 week all together and mimic to a certain degree what we have now as Surgical Skills Week, but really make it a much richer week. So they will learn slit lamp examination during this time. They will learn suturing skills, how to be sterile. And this will be the time where students will be prepared to go into the hospital and the clinics and understand what the basic surgical skills are that they need to start their rotations. There will be 2 weeks of surgery, which will include clinical shadowing as well as operating room time. There will be 2 weeks of anesthesia, a week of radiology, and a week of ophthalmology. And all of these courses are just in the process of being developed. There will also be academic half days during this block. So once a week, the students will all come together. And they will, again, regardless of what they are actually participating in that week, will have an academic half day that has to that is related to surgery, anesthesia, radiology, and or ophthalmology. There might be some academic half days where you'll have radiology and surgery collaborating on topics, and you'll have other days that may be just related to one discipline. The last week of this rotation will be a whole cohort idea. Again, the whole cohort will come together and be divided into small group sessions, but they'll all be doing the same thing at the same time, where they will be working through cases and hopefully, again, some collaboration with the surgery, anesthesia, radiology, and ophthalmology team to bring what they've learned over the last 7 weeks together. And I will mention in all three blocks, there will be separate evaluations and assessment during each of the small rotations within the blocks. But in addition, every block will end with a more comprehensive evaluation that will test the students on everything that they've learned. So in the block where there's internal medicine and neurology, there will be an evaluation that includes neurology and internal medicine topics, and the same with this block and the next block. The final block we called comprehensive care, and this is includes family medicine, pediatrics, medical ethics and health law, and public health, and many more topics as well. There will again be academic half days, probably 2 academic half days, and what we'd really like to do is these academic half days will include family medicine, pediatric topics, public health topics, and we are hoping to include some basic sciences as well on topics perhaps that didn't have a chance to be covered in the first 18 months, but that are related to some of the clinical topics that we're going to be teaching the students. In addition, family medicine will be organizing CLSC visits, but not tapping into the CLSCs nor the family physicians that will be participating in the first year of the curriculum, but rather more related to vaccination clinics, social pediatrics, maternal child health, home care visits, issues that are related to family medicine and that are occurring in the CLSCs that the students would not have otherwise been exposed to. And they'll be taught the male and female general exams at the simulation center. What is lacking in the current ICM model is that there really isn't very much practical pediatric teaching in terms of history and physical exams. So the students start clerkship in pediatrics, and they're very afraid to go near a baby, talk to a parent. They talk to a parent asking questions as if the 3-month-old is 30 years old. You can tell I'm in pediatrics because I'm sensitive to that. And the students really, they are really, really looking for earlier pediatric exposure. They will have had some experience with physical exam skills, and so the focus now is to somehow, some way, provide that kind of teaching in this block, along with community pediatric exposure in terms of clinics. We are, as I mentioned, we're going to integrate more themes and interest groups. We're going to have an ultrasound day. There will be palliative care sessions. So we will be integrating a lot of other sessions into this block in a meaningful way. And just a few days ago, we were talking about a family medicine pediatrics project to allow the students to have some time on their own, self-directed learning, but that could be assessed. So I'll now pass over the mic to Beth Cummings, who will talk about the new clerkship.
Thank you very much. I feel like I'm last, but I hope not least. On this marathon. So as Laurie has already mentioned, and Colin before me, every group that's presented here has been represented by a committee. And in the case of the development of the clerkship schema, we had a clerkship new curriculum implementation committee that also had varied representation from students, faculty, and administrative levels. And it was together with this group that we came up with four guiding principles to really focus our development of the new clerkship curriculum. Our first guiding principle, to quote from Stephen Covey, is to begin with the end in mind. And what we mean by that is the principle of constructive alignment, which is an important principle in medical education that says that you have to design a curriculum based on the outcomes that you want to achieve. We know that students have to graduate with the desired skills and attributes. As Rob Primavesi has already mentioned, the attributes of the McGill graduate and the MDCM objectives and the MCC clinical presentations that have also already been mentioned. In addition, it's important as an accreditation requirement for undergraduate medical education to have a centrally managed curriculum that allows the oversight to be certain that the things that have to be covered are covered without any significant gaps, and at the same time that there aren't any significant redundancies that prevent us from covering things that we should be covering in the curriculum. So the curriculum has to be designed to promote the learning of all of these objectives as well as the assessment of all of the objectives, and therefore assessment has to be thought of throughout the curriculum development process. Our second important guiding principle is that clerkship is part of a greater whole. So as you've already heard from both Colin and Lori, students will be arriving in clerkship with a set of knowledge and skills and things that they will have already learned earlier in the curriculum, as well as things that they will have learned prior to starting medical school. And so in clerkship, we need to build on that knowledge, the skills and attitudes that they've already learned during prior phases of the curriculum. Focus on those things in clerkship that are really part of the clinical skills that have to be learned in a more apprenticeship-type model with direct patient care responsibilities at the bedside. And by the end of clerkship, we have to give students the tools to function at the level of a pluripotent physician, able to succeed in any residency path that he or she chooses. This means that we have to focus on core fundamental clinical skills that are essential to the practice of medicine in multiple disciplines. And we also have to be sure that the themes that have already been elaborated on by Rob Primavesi are understood by the students in multiple clinical contexts because they are essential to the practice of medicine in all disciplines. Our third important guiding principle is that there's more to medicine than university hospital centers. By this we mean that the current clerkship is largely inpatient-based with captive patients in tertiary care environments and is very rotational and time-based in nature. And there's a lot of important strengths in our university hospital centers that we want our students to continue to be exposed to. They're centers in excellence in clinical medicine, in research, and in education. And we feel that maintaining that exposure is still important. However, we feel that having that as the exclusive exposure in the clinical sphere is putting our students at a disadvantage because this becomes their perception of healthcare, while healthcare for the patient is actually largely outpatient-based, ambulatory, in primary and secondary care environments, and is a longitudinal experience wherein they develop relationships with care providers over time. There's an evolution of their symptomatology, conditions, therapies over time. Our fourth important guiding principle was that there's power in integration, and this is something that Lori alluded to as well in speaking about the design of the TCP curriculum. What's important about the concept of integration, and by integration in medical education, we mean students learning multiple disciplines in parallel rather than in series one after the other. What's important about this is that it dissuades students from what I call the learn and purge cycle, where students try to learn everything that they can in the discipline they're currently assigned to, and then attempt to forget it so that they have space in their brains to learn the next thing. Now, we know that educationally that isn't actually how people learn, and you can't empty your brain of things that you've already learned. But it doesn't promote the deep and meaningful learning that we really want students to accomplish. Allowing students to learn multiple things in parallel gives them more opportunity to understand important themes across disciplines. It therefore makes it easier for students to to take skills and attitudes and even knowledge that they've learned in one discipline and apply it to another. So, for example, I'm an internist. I work in an internal medicine clinic where I supervise some of the students, and I always find it miraculous that although they've just finished their family medicine rotation, they seem to think that the hypertension guidelines are different for internal medicine than family medicine. And they don't associate what they've learned in one block as being translatable. They don't necessarily associate all of the patient-related skills or care provider skills that they've learned. The other thing that's very important in an era where patients have a lot of more chronic conditions and where we're trying to think about healthcare and healthcare provision from the point of view of the patient is that the longer a rotational block, the more opportunity there is for longitudinal exposures. One of students' big frustrations now based on their rotation evaluations is that in the outpatient setting and even in the inpatient setting, they often get to see patients. They come up with a hypothesis, a differential diagnosis. They order some tests to try to figure out what the diagnosis actually is, and then they never see the patient again. Or they've actually arrived at a diagnosis, begin a treatment plan, but they have no idea if it's effective or if the patient suffered adverse events. And this leads to a very dissatisfying and incomplete understanding of the healthcare trajectory. Similarly, in surgery, patients may see patients preoperatively and not see them in the operating room or postoperatively, or see them postoperatively only for the 1 or 2 days that they're admitted to hospital and not have the opportunity, because their rotations are completed and the clinical exposures aren't there, to see the patient when they go for follow-up in the surgeon's office several weeks later. So based on those four guiding principles, the clerkship new implementation committee came up with a proposed structure for the new clerkship curriculum. And similar to what Lori described for TCP, there are several blocks, and although they're listed here on the slide in a particular order, students cannot do everything in the same order, and therefore they happen on a rotational basis. Our first block is inpatient and consultative medicine and surgery. And these blocks are all blocks of 16 weeks of time during year three, during which students will have exposure to internal medicine, to surgery. And alongside the internal medicine and surgery, students will have to make sure that the themes are also touched upon, for example, with an evidence-based medicine assignment like a journal club that they have to participate in with attending physicians, an opportunity to make sure that they learn interprofessional education and are also assessed on their interprofessional skills, as well as having some public health-related clinical exposures. And, of course, physicianship will continue to run longitudinally during the curriculum. Our second block is family medicine and mental health, where students will have exposure to family medicine and psychiatry, and again will have opportunities to make sure that the themes are appropriately integrated. The third block includes women and child health, and which is therefore obstetrics and gynecology and pediatrics, and also some time for an elective block. What's important to note, other than the integration of themes, is that by having these 16-week blocks, while there may be some time within each block of concentration within a discipline for particular inpatient or other exposures that are considered very necessary to their learning, there also is an opportunity over the 16-week block or over 12 weeks, depending on the block, to have longitudinal clinics in both disciplines, which gives you in total the same number of clinic hours, but a potentially much richer experience in terms of understanding the evolution of an illness or a condition within a particular patient. Our year four structure includes three mandatory blocks, which are a four-week rotation in geriatric medicine, a four-week rotation in emergency medicine, and a public health selective, with the notion that students will be able to select public health-related clinics that are related to the discipline that they're going to be working in later. So, for example, somebody who's interested in pursuing a career in pediatrics, a residency in pediatrics, may choose to do their selective in public health in social pediatrics. Someone who's interested in internal medicine may do a cardiovascular reduction clinic. And again, the themes are included along the way. In terms of year four, there will also be time for elective rotations, still with the students having ample choice to select the rotations that they want to do towards their residency applications. A new seminar selective, which is somewhat reminiscent of the old back to basics that used to be in the curriculum, where students will have a four-week course at the end of year four after January that will include some basic science selectives, as well as opportunities to do social studies of medicine courses. And the final new course in year four is a course called Transitions, which, as Rob mentioned, really is meant to address the FMEC postgrad recommendation that we need to work better on bridging gaps between silos, to try to bridge the gap better between undergraduate medical education and postgraduate medical education by having an opportunity for students to consolidate some skills, such as crisis resource management, ACLS, for example, at the Simulation Center, also an opportunity to review important concepts in medical ethics and health law, potentially some scientific basic science concepts as they relate as well. So where we are now in terms of the process, as Rob mentioned, this entire strategic planning process began with an education design group report, and that strategic process, planning process began back in 2009. Over time, the Education Design Group report was approved by Lower Campus in around October of 2010. And after that, the different committees got to work thinking about how they could actually put this into practice. The new clerkship schema was developed in 2012 as I presented it today. The TCP schema, as Laurie presented, has been developed at the end of 2012 and beginning of 2013. And we're now at the point for TCP and clerkship of designing the new rotations based on educational methods that are most appropriate for this part of the curriculum, based on the objectives, based on the important educational themes as outlined in the strategic planning process, and all the while thinking about making sure that we assess students on the outcomes that we think really matter. And this process is being certainly overseen by the TCP committee and the Clerkship New Implementation Committee, but is really being spearheaded by the course directors for each of these new courses, some of whom, like Simon Bergman from surgery and Lenny Lala from family medicine, are in the room here today. The new TCP itself is set to start in January of 2015, with the new core clerkship starting in July of 2015, and the new senior clerkship in 2016. And I'll now pass it back to Marion for the final part of the presentation.
So I think you've all been sitting for a while now, and we have to get back to that interactive part. I'm just going to do one little ad for faculty development. Since you've had an hour of like content, you could have an ad now. So there will be a faculty development workshop on May 14th in the afternoon about teaching, interactive teaching in small groups. For all of you who are faculty who know very well how to lecture, we will be offering periodically throughout the year, and May 14th for the first time, a workshop on interactive teaching in small groups. And anybody who's planning to be a longitudinal family medicine preceptor, there will be two workshops, June 11th and August 29th. So that's just a very brief publicity. We would very much like to hear from you, your questions, your comments. I know this was quite a lot of material. Since we are live streaming, I would ask if you can stand up to ask your question, identify yourself, and I will repeat your question after it's been asked, and we will have one of the people on our panel who's most appropriate answer your question. So certainly we're open at this point to any questions people might have. Barry.
I'm Barry Slavkov, and I'm speaking now just as my role as director of the physician apprenticeship course. And it's really directed to Paul and Laurie and Beth. So although it wasn't mentioned specifically on the slide, I just want to comment that physician apprenticeship is still the course that begins sort of in the first week of medical school and continues throughout and ends basically in convocation. So it's the one, I think, part of the curriculum that remained essentially unchanged. I want to thank all of you for that. It's made my life easier. So I just wanted to speak to the value of the awesome fellows that are going to continue throughout the medical school curriculum. I think it's an important point to mention because it wasn't specifically addressed on the slides.
Thank you, Barry. So the point for people on the internet is that the Osler Fellowship physicianship course will continue all through the 4 years and will be integrated into the new curriculum in FMD, TCP, and the new clerkship. Did any of you want to add anything? Or no, it's good. Okay. Yes.
Mike Chabal from Pediatric. I first want to commend everybody for a terrific amount of work in revising the curriculum. As a clinical chair, the one thing, and you got this question yesterday, so you should prep. And I think it deserves a broader audience as well. As a clinical chair,
So the question is about the MUHC move to the Glen Yard in the summer of 2015 and whether that move was considered in the timing, given that the new TCP and clerkship will be also starting in 2015. So I don't know if who would like to address that particular question. Apparently, they've been prepped.
I think it's because I'm the only one who's actually working at the Jewish General Hospital that I've been asked to answer the question. So definitely, Dr. Chevelle, that issue was thought about. Initially, the rollout for the curriculum was meant to be a year earlier, and then because of multiple intervening things, including a MUNECA strike and a resident strike, the development of the curriculum was delayed a year, which is why it now coincides. One of the things that we've thought of as being important is, as I mentioned, that not all of what we're doing in the new curriculum in the clinical environment has to happen within the walls of the hospital. I think that's especially important from the part I understand of the development of the MUHC, that there's a move to have a lot of outpatient clinics happen outside of the hospital walls, although for in large part supervised by the same physicians. And because there's still a lot of unknowns, it's impossible to say, yes, we've planned for every contingency. But I can certainly say that the people who are developing each of the clinical blocks are clinicians involved in all of those clinical environments. And so they will be aware of what's happening within their department and will definitely take feasibility into account when building the blocks. I think the other thing that's of great benefit to us is that Mark Daly is the Director of Education for the MUHC, and I've had the opportunity to meet with him and to liaise with him. So he's actively aware of the changes that we're planning in the new curriculum and has agreed to keep us appraised of changes in the MUHC development that he sees having a significant impact on our educational plan.
I think there was a question. you stand up, you get to go first. Yes, go ahead.
Phil Gold, medicine. As with any other change, there's always a lot of resistance. And most of the people that I know reasonably well are united in their opposition to this. Why? Any change of gaze is a problem. And there's a lot of feeling about the fact that perhaps a science-based curriculum going back to Osler and Flexner is not going to become trade school. Now, that's unfair in the context of what I've heard. But at the end of the day, it also leaves the impression that everything we've done for the last century has been wrong. I mean, I've got to get it right. That bothers me because a lot of the people trained in the old system are going to have to look after me. Now, but at the end of the day, if something isn't working against me, it's not right, then you fix it. But you don't do it by burn and slash. So why are we standing this on its head? Could it not have been fixed? That's the only question for me.
Okay, so I'm going to try and summarize your question. So the question was that since the science-based curriculum has gone back to the time of Osler, what was really so wrong with it that we had to slash and burn? So I'm going to have Colin answer that question.
Thank you, Phil. Phil, of course, has been part of the ongoing email conversation, which I took my quotation from. So I guess 2 points. One is to accommodate a meaningful family medicine experience, which I think we, not just me, but those who were involved in looking at the curriculum think is lacking now. That has inevitable knock-on implications for what happens in the classroom. You know, students can only be in one place at one time. And so that means that the number, the sort of apparently infinite number of lecture hours that we think we have now is going to be less than it is. You can't get away from that. That's issue number one. I think issue number two is that if you sit in the classroom, as I've done for a long time, and talk to students who come through the program, there is a continuous feeling of, I mean, not in every hour of the day, but a continuous concern about why is this enzyme being talked to about for an hour? Maybe it's crucial, but we don't see the connection. And that's a problem throughout BOM as it is right now. Not to say that everything is bad and bomb and it all should be thrown out because of that. third comment is, having been involved in a bomb unit, which is, I think, well received and been doing this for many years, it's very hard to actually make meaningful incremental changes, no matter how hard you try, because, well, you know, Dr. So-and-so has done this lecture forever, and, you know, that's Osler taught him how to do it, and so we, how can we not have that? It's very hard to make real changes without, I wouldn't say slash and burn, but, you know, you say you want a revolution kind of idea. Yeah.
Just to reprise that comment, the problem is that we see ourselves at McGill, I think, in a very specific kind of light. We were always, if you will, the Harvard of the North, or they would have been McGill of the South. And our competition was Cambridge, Harvard, etc. Now we're going to be comparing ourselves to Calgary and interprovincially, which is a bit of a problem for a lot of us, because in order to do that, it's like arguing with a fool. First they knock you down to their level, then they beat you with experience. I'm not sure that I want to change the people with whom we're both competing.
Sure. So, I'm not sure that I can summarize the comment except just to say, I mean, agreed, but I think we also have to be a little careful about being disrespectful of our colleagues elsewhere in the country, which, you know, there, I know you're not meaning that, but that's how it sounds. And our colleagues south of the border in the other Cambridge have gone through exactly the same exercise trying to grapple with this problem. And if you, you know, they write their about their agonies in the New England Journal, but these themes are very, very similar.
That's not true. The Harvard system is not that at all.
With respect, with respect, this is David Eidelman. I'm from the Department of Medicine also. When we did this reflection, we actually consulted people from some of these august institutions, such ne'er-do-well places like UCSF and Harvard. And many of the ideas that are here actually came from those places. So it's a bit absurd to say that we're not comparing ourselves to peers. It's true that the content of the science in terms of lecture hours is reduced. There's no question about that. But if you look at the curriculum that was put in place in the early 20th century after the Flexner Report, that was to counter diploma mills, right? That was the history. McGill was lucky. We were classified one of the few good schools because we actually had laboratories. Yeah. But you'll also remember that there were 2 years of anatomy at that time. Yeah. Okay, and when the anatomy was cut back to only 6 months in my day, okay, it was seemed to be the end of the world. Anatomy is even shorter now. And it's again the end of the world. This change will again be the end of the world. I would submit to my esteemed scientifically oriented colleagues who are involved in such things as molecular biology and so forth, or genetics or proteomics, how much of the science you're doing now did you learn in med school? Okay. Answer, almost nothing. Okay. Certainly the science I do now, I learned as in my adult life, post-med school, way post-med school, because I was engaged in research. I would submit that our task is to prepare students for a variety of different careers in medicine. Frankly, even in your day, Phil, most of the class who I've met at the reunions became clinicians, okay? Not everybody was a Phil Gold or a David Goldsmith or a Barry Posner or a person like that. We have to have a curriculum that, at this one hand, prepares people for a clinical career that is scientifically informed, and also provides the opportunity for those, always a minority in the class, people who are scientifically minded, to be able to get exposed enough and have opportunities enough to spend time in John's lab or David's lab or whatever. That's the goal. In addition, it's very important that students be engaged. For many years, I don't know if Jim Martin's here or anybody from the rest group, but I gave a lecture, which originally was Millick Emily's lecture when I was a student. It was one of my great privileges was to give the same lecture that Millick Emily gave. Nobody here knows who Millick Emily is, but and John did. Everybody over 50 knows who Millick Emily is. And his son, who was in Toronto. But I had those lectures, and then I gave them. And I had the distinct privilege, even though my ratings were high, to sit in that class and watch people chat, just like they chatted when I was in that class. Okay, even though I had Will Hamlin, who was one of the most brilliant showmen in history in presenting things. And I think even in Phil Gould's class, there's some people who are talking, maybe not. Very few of us, very few of us can aspire to Phil's mastery in the classroom. Nevertheless, when you actually talk to the students, I don't know how much they get out of the lectures. Okay, that's the point. And part of it is because they're not mature enough yet, most of them, to put together abstract concepts they're getting in the lecture and then go apply in the classroom. The idea here is to try and take principles of adult learning and put them closer together so that people can make the connections. Now you're thinking to yourself, people with R scores of 37 who, you know, cured cancer before they got into med school and so on in order to get an interview must be able to do everything. But I think those of us who have experience with med students know that despite their almost infinite talent, they're just kids. Okay? A lot of them are, anybody who's younger than my kids is just kids. They're just kids, and it takes time for them to put it all together for most of them. Maybe not the most brilliant, but most of the students. And so I would beg the indulgence of people who are upset to remember that it wasn't the golden age you recall, it wasn't as golden as you remember, that science is not being ejected from the curriculum. But rather, the goal here is to try and teach scientific principles at the time where a student is actually going to care. Okay? And if you're learning RESP, when I used to, as time went on, we made ours more and more clinical. I started showing x-rays during my class because the students were interested. It also was my distinct pleasure before they kicked me out of teaching was to have students put up their hand and explain that Wikipedia pointed out that I was wrong. And the coefficient for the gas, binding coefficient was not exactly what I said it was, but it was some other number. So the year after, I actually quoted Wikipedia and said, for this class, the coefficient is this number. We're in an age in which data, facts, and information are freely available. Our students do not need to come to med school or grad school to learn facts. What they need to come is to learn how to think, how to learn, okay, and how to master ideas. What we hope, and certainly because I and John and Joyce were sort of the core group that started this, what we hope is that this curriculum will teach people to be ready to become doctors, because when you finish med school, all you're ready to do is a residency, and then you learn to be a doctor. To have the potential to understand scientific concepts, so if they're turned on by that, they can pursue it, and if they're not, they at least know something about it, and to be ready to learn throughout their lives. Okay? So this is the whole philosophical underpinning of this curriculum. Is it perfect? Undoubtedly no. Okay? Is it better than the old curriculum? Probably not, because the old curriculum was very good when it started. But I remind you, David Goldsmith was the leader of that thing. And when was that? What was the
94. New 94.
So we are radically rushing ahead to reform, you know, only, you know, 90 years later. So, you know, I don't think that we're being particularly radical to change a curriculum after almost two decades when the world, as was shown in the first slide, has changed so much. We need to, I am sure it will take 3 to 5 years before this curriculum is perfected. And I'm sure, I see Dr. Wexler nodding. She must have been through several curricular reforms by now. And I'm sure the same was true for the last few. In fact, I know, since I was involved with some of them, that was true for the previous curriculums. But it's important that we change so that we are able to prepare our students for the world they're going to face, which is very different than the world that I faced when I was there. Sorry for that speech, but I was using my decanal privilege.
Actually, there are a few people who have had their hands up for quite a while, so I will remember you. We should have given numbers out. There was a question way in the back for quite a while.
that I
following up on some of these themes. You mentioned, Rob, in your talk, one of the lines was research. And then when I looked for the curriculum, I just was wanting to know specifically when and where will there be research exposures? And following on that, for people who are interested in being a small percentile, what will be the impact of the new curriculum on things like the MD PhD program or other avenues to become clinician scientists?
So the question is about research in the new curriculum, and I think it was directed to Rob. Would you like to take that question?
So the question was about research, and it actually is listed as one of the themes. And there actually will be a research course that will introduce students to the principles of research that will run longitudinally with FMD, so throughout the first 18 months. And there will be a deliverable at the end of those 18 months, and it's obviously not going to be a complete project in that period of time. But students will have another deliverable at the end of the 4 years, and there will be actually an opportunity to actually carry out a project to completion with a faculty mentor or supervisor during that time. And we want to leave pretty broad. If somebody wants to do something that's clinical based or lab based or something that's maybe more social studies of medicine, very interested in getting involved. So there will be deliverable, and so students will get an introduction to the principles and how to go about asking a research question and such, which is missing from the current curriculum. And I might add that despite that, from the 2012 Canadian graduation questionnaire, two-thirds of McGill grads actually are involved in research during medical school, even though it's not an official part of the curriculum. And hopefully that will actually be more with the new curriculum. As far as the MD-PhD program, there's actually no plans for that to change with the new curriculum. So will be an MD-PhD program where students can apply and they can complete their PhD within medical school. By actually taking a leave of absence, it'd be very nice. Sort of my vision, and I think Salim's vision, is that it'd be nice for the PhD students when they're away for their 3 or 4 years during the PhD that they're somehow still connected to the medical schools, because they kind of really disappear and we don't see them for 4 years, and all of a sudden they're back. So we want to find a way to engage them, and we are actually working on a pilot for an MD MSc, which may be more doable.
How about right back here?
John Trevank from General Surgery. I applaud the fact that you're taking the students away from hospital-based exposure to the surgeries towards maybe a more outpatient use. But I just need to understand, how is this going to happen and who's going to be doing the teaching? I have a fond appreciation for my family doctors. My two parents were for many years family doctors. I've been exposed to family medicine quite a long time. Actually, I like to say that I'm probably one of the last general surgery residents to have done a rotating internship. So I really like to know. A lot of our patients now worked up. They come in after surgery and they go home. And so I think this is good, but is this going to be mentorship based, or is this going to be walk in the general clinic and anybody, kind of the students are lost in the shuffle? And the other thing that we have lost, because the fact that medical students are not allowed to spend the night or overnight following their chief residents or senior residents to the emergency ward, a lot of that exposure was great because this is a way for them to see acute care. And now we have an acute care-based general surgery service, and this is an opportunity perhaps to send students there to be exposed to the care part of general surgery.
Okay, so the question was about how general surgery will be changed in the new curriculum, and when it's taught in the outpatient setting, how will that happen, how it will be operationalized, and also whether students could be doing acute care surgery overnight. I think Beth Cummings will take that question.
Thanks very much for that very pertinent question, Dr. Chemenkov. So first I'll start by commenting a bit on the literature on longitudinal integrated clerkships, of which we're kind of building a hybrid model and not going in my view, as extreme as the real longitudinal integrated clerkships are. There's some really good examples of urban longitudinal integrated clerkships, including at Harvard, run by David Hirsch, and including at UCSF Parnassus, run by Anne Poncelet, both of whom I've had extensive discussions with about our plans. And what they do is actually have an entire curriculum that's based in family medicine during clerkship, and the students have a patient panel so that they will see a patient with a chronic condition, a patient with who's pregnant, a patient who has lots of different types of things, and then they follow that patient through all of their healthcare experiences, both with the family physician and also with the other healthcare providers. And there's data from them as well as from our colleagues in Calgary and UBC and elsewhere, and NOSM and Northern Ontario Medical School, that shows that the students who go through these curricula perform as well on the Medical Council of Canada examinations and match as well to specialties and do as well in residency as students who have gone through the more traditional based stream. Though the principle underlying that is really the continuity of care with the patient, continuity of context where they're in a particular learning environment for a period of time, and continuity of peer group, and also continuity of supervision with a particular preceptor. And we know that that works, but we felt that for our McGill environment, given the way our hospital structure is built, that doing that would prove extremely difficult, especially with the longitudinal family medicine program happening at the same time. So we've chosen to draw on the strength of our clinical specialists, of which we have, thankfully, many, many here within our university, and instead gone with a model where there's an opportunity to draw on the strengths of the specialty, still have a strong grounding in generalism, be it in family medicine, but also in the other general specialties. So I think that's to address your question about the teaching in general. Related to what's going to happen within each of the blocks, so as I alluded to when I was speaking earlier, each of the clinical blocks is actually being developed by, in most cases, the current clerkship director or ICM director or both for the rotation. So Simon Bergman is taking the lead for surgery and Peter Galley for internal medicine for that inpatient and consultative medicine and surgery block. One of the things that both Peter and Sima have mentioned to me as being important is preserving some of that inpatient experience, preserving access to acute care patients, preserving access to the operating room, preserving access for the opportunity to see undifferentiated patients who have medical and surgical problems, work within a team supervised by residents and attending physicians, but also have the opportunity to see some of the things that, as you yourself mentioned, are happening outside of the hospital walls. The details of how that's going to happen still haven't totally been worked out because that involves a process of more extensive consultation. So to that end, I presented at Grand Rounds with Sima and Sebastian Demetinier from surgery at the MUHC, and we'll be doing the same at the JGH and St. Mary's, and I've done the same for other disciplines. We have more coming up to give an opportunity for each of the clinical disciplines to hear a bit of the background and then have an opportunity to have a group think around practically how do we achieve these objectives with the resources that we have and where else do we have to reach out for? Do we have to reach out to, for surgery, some community hospitals, to surgeons who work with us but have their offices outside the hospital walls? And all of that's going to depend a bit on the structure within the department at the university level, and how things can best be arranged to help students meet the objectives. Does that address what you were asking?
Yeah, and I want to add something. Maybe this is an opportunity to rethink how we deliver healthcare. 12 years ago, I came up with the idea to then Dr. Jonathan Meekins that we should have a day care or a day hospital where we have major subspecialties and family medicine a one-stop shop for the patient. It might deliver healthcare in a different way so that you have a general surgeon when someone needs a general surgeon. You have an internist. You have major specialties all coming together in a shopping mall, if you want, a clinic. And that way we can teach our students as well. It's a way to rethink the way we deliver medicine.
I think that's a fascinating point. I'm not sure that I have the power to respond to that one. But I did. I absolutely agree that thinking outside the box is important. And Dr. Primavesi just reminded me I didn't address your issue about being on call. Our on-call policy in medical school very much parallels the on-call policy for residents, which now sets a maximum day at 16 hours. One of the things that we're looking at in the new curriculum is how to bring back an overnight experience for students in lots of different disciplines, in particular surgery and medicine, because we've noticed now that the students who have not done it have started residency, that their comfort with dealing with acute care problems has decreased.
We have lots more questions, I see that. I'm going to try to be fair. With the bow tie, he said.
David Rosenblatt for Human Justice. Well, let me really congratulate. I've been trying actually to defend some of the email. I have some concerns about the basic science side, but I cannot fault the thinking and the time that has gone into the process and the professionalism for which it's been done. Everybody doesn't like change, but it's a different issue. But I think there two things. One of the things that the dean brought up, and you never want to be in the same scene as children or the dean, but I think probably lectures can disappear because the students frankly don't attend them, or a very small percentage of the class attend them. But what I always tell students, you're not coming to the lecture for the content, but just what the dean was saying. Exposure to the characters in the medical school and the variety of people that maybe you'll find someone to serve as a role model for you and all these people, but maybe we have a series of set lectures that just go on the web and not waste the time of the lecturers who see a third of the class and want to know if we're handing out the notes. But I do worry, having faced the small groups, given that we take more people out of CEGEP, and I was the equivalent of the CEGEP brat because I was grade 11 high school straight into medicine. But I would much rather be dealing in first year medicine with someone who's gone through David Thomas's biochemistry course for your program in terms of the depth they understand the discussion in science. It's not their fault. They're bright as hell. But they had their last year they were studying voice and went to medicine because they weren't good enough to make it in voice. At the international level, because much harder to be the best soprano in the world than the best doctor at McGill, So it's hard. So these people don't. So I really think the working with admissions is very important. But now a very parochial question. You addressed the question that there's awful opportunity to be exposed to electives to go them to make their CARMS choices. And many of us work in subspecialties with very few entry slots, requiring these people to go to other places and also here to get some sort of exposure. And these subspecialties, surgical subspecialties, genetics, other things, don't get exposure to these kids early on, unless their father happened to be a geneticist or orthopedic surgeon or something that is not part of the main curriculum. They don't get to see this early. I still see this as a problem for a school like McGill that has a lot of excellent subspecialties and disciplines that have minor exposures. And the other thing that sort of stems from that is I still see a top front heavy curriculum with a very weak, fourth year to me, almost from Christmas on, is a waste. It's always been setting in back to basics, a whole bunch of the spill your time, what people worry about what CARMS match they're going to get and what they're going to do for the rest of their lives. And I see a little bit of that here, unless those transition to residency is a real rigorous transition process, rather than how do you fill your time until you find a way to get your CARMS match. So those are my things.
Okay, so there were some concerns raised about exposure of medical students to different subspecialties, and also some questions about the fourth year of medical school, the last 6 months, and if it's just a waiting period. So I think Beth will address those.
So thanks very much, Dr. Rosenblatt, for that question. So regarding the issue of the end of medical school, I'll start with that one first just because it's fresher in my mind. One of the things that we really struggled with is what to do with that time at the end of medical school. We know from the clinical setting that because the dean's letters have already been submitted and CARMS applications are already in, that the students who have clinical rotations at that time, which right now are emergency medicine, geriatrics, and the surgery subspecialties, really don't benefit from them at all. And in a sense, it puts different people in the class in a different circumstance because they've done a different amount of mandatory clinical rotations before the CARMS deadline. So we've decided that there was a lot of wisdom to the concept of let's use the time after the clinical rotations have been completed and the dean's letter process is all underway, to allow the students to learn things that they didn't have the capacity to understand before they've had the clinical exposure, but that they really need for the practice of medicine later. So with the basic science and social studies of medicine seminar selective, there will be rigorous assessment in some form depending on the course that students take. And for the transitions course, that's 6 weeks, there's really, in concept, we don't yet have a course director for that course, but in concept there's three main themes. There's transition through licensure, which involves LMCC review sessions, as well as learning about ethics and health law. There's also transition through practice, which is an opportunity to practice at the simulation center, some of the other skills, as well as work on communication skills and other concepts of physicianship. And I no longer remember the third theme. Oh, right. Yes, and the concept at the end of that as well is to have some assessment built in, but until we know the details of the course, it's impossible to comment more. In terms of the elective exposure, the average in Canadian medical schools is between 12 and 20 weeks of electives for medical students. In the new curriculum, we will have 16 weeks, and in the current curriculum, we have 20 weeks of elective time. All of that will be before the interviews, before January of the fourth year. There's one elective that's maintained in year three that will be at a different time for different students, and a lot of schools have all their electives in year four. And in year four, students will be doing 12 weeks of electives as well as 12 weeks of mandatory rotations in the first 24 weeks of the year. And again, for different students, those will be in different orders, so they'll still have opportunity to choose the electives that they're interested in. I do think your point about subspecialties, and some of which are entry-level subspecialties, is an important one. I think our history at McGill with the electives that we have now is that students who think they're interested in things definitely look for those opportunities. There's always going to be a student who does something late who says, oh, I wish I had done it sooner. But I don't think that that can really be avoided in any curriculum where everybody can't do everything at the same time.
To just add a comment about lectures, David, it's interesting. Many in the room will know that all lectures that we give in Basis of Medicine now are recorded, and so you can sit on a beach in Perth and be a medical student in theory. But despite that, the room's still full. So they come from, well, I mean, tell you.
It's full when you lecture.
Well, okay, but I'm there when a lot of other people are lecturing, too. And, you know, Jim Brower and I actually did a study on this a couple of years ago. Why do students come to lecture? And it's clear that it's not just a dinosaur. There's still some value in it. What we want to do is get it done well, consistently. I must say, though, David, that according to what Beth's students, first-year students, tell me, they seem to be more interested in what tie I'm wearing than anything else. So it's, I'm not sure what they're really getting out of it.
We have quite a few questions over here. How about, I know in the back, in the black, you've had your hand up for a while. So we are at our 6:30 time slot that we were supposed to end, but we're happy to continue the discussion, but we know some people might have to leave. Yes.
Should know and nice to know is going to be really helpful when it comes to organizing the principles that we attend. organizing the way that we approach clinical medicine.
Thank you for that. So just very briefly, a third-year medical student just summarized that she's very happy to hear that there will be more family medicine in the new curriculum to make things more clinically relevant, and that there perhaps is indeed an information overload in BOM as it stands right now. How about we go over to this side? Yes, a question?
Students are upset. They don't like being put in front of fire hydrants. We need to produce a lot more general practitioners. Let's be practical and adapt to the world as it is, not to the world as we would like it. My main concern is that what we are going to do with this process, it worries me, okay? I know that there are good people, all of you are good people. You've done your best at evaluating and struggling with a very difficult issue. It is a difficult issue. How do we go about educating young people in an intelligent way in the science of medicine, in the art of medicine, in compassion, in physicianship, in professionalism? How do we do that? That's a very, very tall order, a very difficult thing. What I'm concerned is the change that's taking place is going to sacrifice something very important, and that is the teaching that occurs in the basic sciences, despite the fact that there are those who feel they're in front of a water hose. Teaching that occurs in the basic sciences is not simply to give facts, the essential facts, the should facts, or the pleasant facts that may not be quite relevant. It's not about that. It's teaching them to think about the science of medicine in an intelligent way. The basic course in cell biology is designed to create a view, a world perspective, and a sense of how to think about these issues. When we give our teaching in metabolism, we don't stuff it full of facts and details. We just try to keep to the central principles so that they learn to think about these issues. That's what I'm concerned is being sacrificed. That's my main worry.
So in summary, there's concerns that are raised about teaching of the basic sciences in the new curriculum because it's not a question of transmission of facts, but a way of teaching about thinking in science. I don't know, Colin, do you want to address the process of learning to think as a scientist?
Barry, it's a legitimate concern. I don't pretend that we're going to avoid that problem. All I can tell you is, having observed BOM in action for a long time, the process you're describing, teaching science to teach people a paradigm of how to look at the world and think about disease and think about patients, does happen successfully quite often in BOM, but there are many other times when it isn't happening. And the focus is on detail that's very difficult to understand why it's being taught, except that the particular speaker thinks it's important. So finding the golden mean between those two is what we're trying to do. I think a way to move forward with that is try as much as we can to contextualize the science.
Could I comment?
Absolutely.
I appreciate the comment. I think that's one way of solving it. But what we might have done that might have been helpful was to bring the teachers together, retreat or some kind of faculty meeting or something, bringing the teachers together and say, look, we have a problem here. Some of you may be doing the job, some of you are not doing the job. This is an issue that has to be solved. We want you to start thinking hard about what you're doing in your classes, what kind of information you're transmitting, what is being given that is overly detailed and overly and not particularly relevant to pathophysiology and understanding the disease process. That I can understand, but I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think that took place.
Well, I mean, in fact, it has and is still taking place. So the basic structure of FMD in the blocks, in responsible for each of the blocks is one of our colleagues, and I show them one of my slides, all the various names. The assignment that they've been given by me and my committee is, this is your subject matter in broad strokes. this, and this is what we have done related to this in the current curriculum. These are the teachers. Let's look at this all over again and see how we can do it better. And that means that individual block leaders have consulted with many, not necessarily every teacher in every block. But has it been done in a grand public forum? No, because I personally think that kind of thing is actually more effectively done one-on-one in small meetings over time.
We have a few hands back there that have been up for a while. Do you want to go?
Hi, so my name is Erica Walbich. I'm also a third year medical student, and I see a lot of strengths in the new curriculum. I think that personally being very interested in family medicine from the beginning, and thinking to me like the way to have a very strong healthcare system is to have very strong family physicians who are able to use healthcare resources effectively and be very intelligent clinical thinkers. I think that this curriculum really does emphasize that and gives you tools early on to start thinking in that way. If medical knowledge is doubling every 7 years, or that's kind of something that we're saying, the most important thing we need to be able to get out of this curriculum is to learn to be good learners. Because although I actually love lectures, and although I didn't do voice, I did a drama degree before this, I think that there's something to, first of all, what Dr. Pringvesi was saying, which is to select applicants in such a way that yes, they do have the prerequisites, the life experience, and the ability to learn clinically and also scientifically from the first beginning of these half-day lectures onwards. And I think that right now, being in clerkship, I see that, oh, I wish I could actually go back and do BOM again. You know, we joke about that sometimes because we have such a different appreciation and understanding. And the way that you see that knowledge now is so different in third year than it was in first year. In first year, it is kind of one of those things where you're going through we're going through the information to learn it, but we don't really understand why is that important until much later on. And then it's kind of too late to have utilized that wonderful, subspecialist lecture to its full potential because it's already so far behind us. What I would say that worries me about the new curriculum is just the idea that one last thing about family medicine is I think that the fact it's going to be more longitudinal is so important. Funnily enough, right now in clerkship, family medicine is the point in your clerkship where you'll probably have the least longitudinal exposure to your patients because you're for 1 month with usually different preceptors watching you, and you'll probably only see that patient once or maybe twice if they really have a condition that warrants seeing them again within a month. And so actually in family medicine we find that we're the most scattered, and it's the least what we as future family physicians aspire to be and aspire to see in our discipline. So I think it's really good to have that longitudinal and from the beginning, because we also aren't exposed to it much. And when I finally got to family medicine, I was like, yes, I knew this is what I wanted all along. But I got confused along the way because there's just so many other specialties that can seem appealing. So the last thing I'd say that just worries me is, as far as inpatient wards, I think that is an important clinical exposure. And I understand that it's kind of still in the works, but that potentially one of the thoughts was to have half days on specific wards. I don't know if that may be what happens or not. But, so I just think that even now when we're only half days on any given inpatient ward, like that's a bit of a disaster because as medical students, it's easier for the resident to do the work if we're only there half a day, even if it's for a clinic for the other half day or whatever. So if that was the case, I think that would be the only thing that I find it would be important to still have that kind of block of time where for a certain period of time we are on wards and we are expected to manage patients, to see them daily, to make management plans and all of that. And I think that that's my only thing that I can kind of, because it's sort of a little bit abstract still, I guess. But anyway, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So this was a medical student commenting on the importance of the integration of clinical and basic sciences to maximize the usefulness for the student and importance of continuity in family medicine. Did you sort of already kind of address her question, I think? Do you feel okay?
Can I just find- find out, like, what is the thoughts for, like, for example, surgery and internal medicine being done kind of as a block?
So the question is basically, are the students going to have a kind of inpatient experience where they will follow patients longitudinally to have that kind of continuity?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. As I mentioned before, the blocks are still being developed, and they're being developed by the course directors for those particular blocks. But the course directors for medicine and surgery, as well as the clerkship curriculum, new curriculum implementation committee, feel that the inpatient exposure is important and are well aware, as people who work in those clinical environments, about the impact of having people who are there briefly and then not there. One of the things that's important to avoid in any curriculum is medical tourism, where basically you're in a place long enough for people to know who you are but not know what you're capable of doing. And that's detrimental when you're trying to be a clerk and learn in a situation where basically people have to entrust you to do things, and that's definitely being considered in the development of the blocks.
So we have two people who've been waiting for a while. You two, do you want to go, and then you, and then we'll see how we're doing for time.
Has gotten you where you want to go, which is to, I think, the first slide said, make us the premier medical school in Canada. What are you going to use? The McLean's rankings? Our grades on the students when they take the exams? What are you going to use as an outcome?
So thank you. That's an excellent question, and the question is about evaluation of the new curriculum and how will we know that we're achieving what we're trying to achieve. So Rob has all kinds of ideas about that.
Thanks for asking the easy question last, and I would say that Beth loves assessment. As such, that's probably going to be our most challenging thing to do. We have a job posting for somebody for helping us with assessment within the new curriculum predominantly. So that's actually assessing students to go along, so we can actually build good measuring tools of how students do along the way, which is different from, with Yvonne here, program evaluation, which is what we probably really need to see what the program outcomes are. Right now we have surrogate markers, so we can see how our students do on the LMCC exams compared to other schools, how they do on the national board exams that we're using as end of clerkship measures right now, but that may change as we develop our own in-house measures. So. Yes, we should have the assessment already built in, and we're still working on it.
Yes.
Thank you. So I'm not an MD, but I would like to add to the concerns of Dr. Gold and Dr. Posner. I'm part of this group as well, and I've interacted with Dr. Chalk, and I thank him for his patience, and other colleagues. And I want to address the brand of McGill, which, as I've observed over the years, and I've written about it many, many places, produces physician scholars. A physician scholar is not a clinical scientist. Forget clinical science. So I know it's the same neurons in your brain that are hitting clinical scientist and physician scholar. Separate that. Physician scholar is a scholar. When I click on the Harvard website that I sent to all of you, they produce physician scholars, and their curriculum is not at all like this. Even though they may write you and say, fabulous, great, do it, do the experiment, they produce physician scholars. And what they do is they impose on their students, rightly or wrongly, a grounding in basic science in a very formal way that will drive them for the rest of their life in terms of making decisions from clinical care to family practice. And I realize even clinical science sometimes, that will allow them to be the international leaders that the physician scholar of McGill is. So there are many examples that I've written about in this, the Nobel Prize winners that have come out of the MD program of McGill, not the MD PhD program, the MD program. Most recent Nobel Prize winner at the Rockefeller was a physician that was trained here as a physician scientist. So my point is that in the curriculum, you have designed it to remove the value of scholarship. That has been obliterated. I appreciate that the interest is heightened immensely because now the practicality of practicing the skill of a physician is enhanced. But the whole point of a physician scholar is to prepare you for the unknown that's going to come around in the next generation. And so I'm very concerned. It's not a concern. It's, to me, obvious. There's been a decision to remove the brand of physician scholar from the McGill graduate. And this, I don't see how that's going to enhance the quality of the student that's graduating from our program by removing the basic science.
So the question is?
The question is, what is the rationale for no longer training physician scholars?
Okay, so the assertion is that physician scholars have been removed from the new curriculum, and the question is, what is the rationale for that? So I guess I don't know who would like to field that question.
So, John, there actually is no conspiracy theory. Don't worry. And I'm not sure that anywhere in the writings of the medical school now the term, the idea that McGill is producing physician scholars is actually a mission statement. It may be what happens, but I don't know that it's written down anywhere.
So you disagree that McGill has had a tradition in producing physician scholars?
I agree. I think that...
I
would say that, yes, many of the graduates of this august institution over 150 years have been physician scholars. Many more of them have been humble practitioners who simply take care of the
ill. Using scholarships for their practice.
Ah, but does that make them physician scholars?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what we produce.
So I don't think that we're going to be doing anything differently.
So can I use a specific example?
Okay.
You brought up, and another member of the curriculum brought up, as information that is in the nice to know and not the essential to know.
Okay.
Right? And when I saw this, I said, my God, you know, is the earth flat? I couldn't believe this. The example that two folks used was the following. It's nice to know, but come on. This pathway of going from glucose through to the Krebs cycle, right? So there are 10 steps in glycolysis, 2 ATPs, 10 steps in the Krebs cycle, 2 ATPs, and the electron transport chain, 28 ATPs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the central foundation for how every cell and organ in the body works. And
mm-hmm.
to put this in the nice-to-know category, when there have been 6 Nobel Prizes given in this, I found astonishing. I couldn't believe it. So this is the schism that's happened now. So this is now in the nice-to-know category, and this defines us as saying, we're not interested in scholarship.
Well, unless I had an absence, I don't remember Krebs being brought up prior to what you... until you brought him up, and I certainly did not say Krebs is nice to know. What one must know about the Krebs cycle, one can debate. And
but you mentioned specifically glucose metabolism.
I didn't mention glucose metabolism.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever. Oh no. Okay. No. Okay. Well, I'm talking about today.
Okay.
Don't talk about meetings. There is no question that the scientific principles that underlie the function of cells in the body are important. Nobody disputes that. The question is, you could take the argument to its furthest extent and say, in order to understand how cells work, we really need to understand quantum mechanics, because that's
no,
the
that's
foundation
nonsense.
Of everything.
No,
that's nonsense.
Nonsense.
It's carrying the argument. I'm not saying that.
That's a real world here.
Yeah, well, that's carrying the argument in the same,
yeah,
in the same direction.
So
what we need to do, though, is we need to try to figure out in the Krebs cycle, in all that massive detail, what actually are the essential things that a practicing doctor needs to carry in his back pocket. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
By removing basic science, you don't give the opportunity for anyone to appreciate what's possible.
Nobody is removing basic science.
I didn't see it.
I'm happy to sit down and show you day by day what we're planning to do. Perhaps we should do that. But I think the rest of the audience doesn't need to be subjected
okay.
to it.
Excuse me, could we just quickly speak to that as medical students?
Okay, we'll have you two speak, and then Dr. Cummings
sure.
also wants to respond.
Go ahead.
Thanks. So I definitely think that the debate about how much basic science is enough is a very important one. But I would like to comment that I feel very strongly that we're not removing scholarship from the new curriculum. I think that instead we're trying to think of scholarship as being broader than only scholarship that involves basic science. And by making a mandatory research project and having a research-driven curriculum, giving students opportunities to find out what scholarship means to them. Similarly, with our new theme of evidence-based medicine, we're asking students to critically appraise the articles that they're reading, which requires an understanding of the science. It requires an understanding of the methods. It requires an understanding of the clinical problems. And in my view, will actually help develop people who are better placed to become scholars when they find the niche within that scholarship that most appeals to them.
They haven't built the foundation for doing the research or reading the papers. They can't do it. They can't do it.
So, I don't know if just I could maybe speak to that as a medical student, but actually the prerequisites that we are required to have to enter medical school include biochemistry, in which we study in great detail, in much more detail, in fact, that could be possibly taught in a basic science course. When we see it in class, I believe it's like a half an hour that we would spend covering something that I would have spent in my biochemistry class a month covering. So in fact, yes, there are refreshers of some of those things, but most of those kind of things that you're speaking to, like biochemistry and the Krebs cycle and all of that, is stuff that we come into medical school being expected to know. And again, I did a drama degree, and then I did 2 years approximately of prerequisite courses in chemistry, biology, biochemistry, so physics.